Okay, last week we talked about the Crusades, and we talked about, I gave you a little handout, which there are some somewhere for anybody that doesn't have them, and I've got to find them. A little handout that talked about, and it was more a concept of what happens in church history, but it directly relates to where we're going tonight. And so I just wanted to touch base. I don't want to revisit the Crusades. We covered that plenty last week. But this little chart that I handed out last week, that of course, if you're listening on the web, you're not going to see this chart. But it's a wonderful chart. And I stole it from somebody. It's not mine. And I said that the history of Christianity, it's somewhere. I'm just looking at it. You found where I stole it from. There you go. It's in the book. I didn't get it out of that book. The guy I stole it from must have stole it from that book, because I stole it from a prof I had in seminary. So, and as you all know, that when it comes to academics, if you steal from one person, that is plagiarizing. But if you steal from more than one person, that's research. So these classes are well researched. Down the center of this chart is biblical Christianity. That's what our goal is to always tie to that. But through the history of the church, the pendulum has swung back and forth across that center line of biblical Christianity to either a focus on emotions or a focus on intellect. And we see it go back and forth in church history. Now, the Middle Ages, early Middle Ages, Middle Ages, have been categorized more in the emotional end. Monasticism started out in sort of a practical vein, but really lent itself to this emotional idea of Christianity, the mysticism and whatnot that we find in the Middle Ages. And towards the end of the Middle Ages, it starts to swing back over to an intellectual end of Christianity, and that's primarily called scholasticism. And we're going to talk about that tonight. As the Crusades ended, things were starting to change, both in European society as well as in the Christian church. One of the things that happened was that economics changed. As you get to the late part of the Middle Ages and after the Crusades, society has changed. It now you're developing almost a middle class in society. You still have the aristocracy. You know, kings and whatnot are just really rich, influential political people. And you still have the poor folks out there just, you know, digging in the dirt, trying to scratch out a life. But you've developed this sort of center group that really becomes dominant after the Crusades within life, economic life, and that's merchants, trade people, folks that make things, folks that trade now that's been opened up through the Crusades. Now, you trade begins throughout the East. Eventually, it'll open up into China. And so you have this group of folks who are, and the economy now is changing to a monetary economy. It's no longer just, you know, nobody had money. And that's the amazing thing to us, to think that for a long period of time, people just didn't have money. You know, some farmer in the early Middle Ages, you know, didn't have a wallet with dollar bills in it, right? He didn't have an ATM card. He just didn't have money. And money was different then, too. You didn't really have a currency like we have and whatnot, and a banking system and all that. But all that's starting to change. So a monetary-based economy is starting to develop now. And as I talked about last time, you know, big cities started to develop, you know, around what used to be, you know, you had a castle and you had folks in the castle, and then you had folks that were sort of protected by the castle folks, the farmers and whatnot. They were outside the gates, but they kind of had their houses close. And then as these merchants and trade people started to become, you know, necessary, the guys that repaired the armor for the castle and the guys that made stuff, wooden stuff and leather stuff and whatnot, or folks that baked bread or whatnot, and now started to put their little offices and homes and workshops there by the castle. And so gradually this evolves to where, you know, this expands out, and now you get a city. And in these cities, you start to have big churches. You no longer have the little parish churches out in the locales. Now you have a big central church that everybody kind of starts showing up at. And this is how the society was changing. Well, there was a reactionary movement within all this within Christianity of the technical term is mendicant religious orders. They're begging monks, okay? Monasteries, you know, for a long time were very formal. They were institutions that were as we have seen, were highly organized, self-contained units. Well, these new group of guys were reacting against the monetary and the economic changes within society, and they were saying this was not good. We were losing some of our focus as Christians, and they saw the huge wealth that was involved in the folks who were running the church. Remember, at this time, there were some really good folks that were running the church, a couple of good popes, some really, really bad popes, some good priests, some bad priests, good bishops. Well, anyway, these guys were reacting against it. And sort of the founder of all this was a guy named Peter Waldo. Later on, everybody was looking for him. It was, where's Waldo? He was a guy who was a fairly rich merchant who had some extraordinary things happen in his life. One of those was he was having dinner with a friend and the friend died, and that absolutely destroyed him. And then he heard some other sermons by prominent religious teachers, and he disagreed with those. And he said, you know, this isn't right. I need to just get rid of my money. That's not being a good Christian. And so through these huge personal things in his life, experiencing a death of a friend and hearing some religious teachings he didn't agree with, he essentially turned into one of these beggar monks. And he gave everything away. And he would just go around to people and say, you need to support me. This isn't right that I'm doing this. And he would beg. Now, he had some very different religious ideas, and the church did not approve what he did. He gathered other guys with him that agreed with him, and he wanted to form sort of a religious order of these mendicant begging monks, and the church shut him down. They forbade it. But about 30, 40 years after Peter Waldo, another guy came along who was very successful, Francis from a little town called Assisi. And Francis had the same idea. And he talked about, in fact, one of the loosely paraphrasing, he told all his friends, I have just gotten married. And they said, who'd you get married to? And he said, Lady Poverty. And he committed his life to live in this way. And he garnered a bunch of guys to come along with him. And this time the church approved it, and the Order of Franciscans was created. And it was this group of begging monks. Now, they weren't just living on the dole of the good-natured Christians. They were providing. They would come in as priests and provide religious education, and they would say mass and do all this stuff. But they lived off of what was given to them. They were not part of the mainstream of Christian fundraising and of life. And so you start to have these. Another guy came along, a guy named Dominic from a little town called Osma. And Dominic was, his focus was on being one of these begging monks, but his focus was on defending the truth of the Christian church. And so the way they earned their money was by preaching. So the followers of Dominic from Osma were preachers. And strong defenders of Orthodox Christianity at the time, preaching against heresies and whatnot. So you have a rise in society of these beggar monks. The next thing you have is you've still got the results of the Crusades. Now, I said that basically we see the Crusades failed. They did not liberate the Holy Land. They did not save the East from Muslim invaders. And they did not stop Islam. They just didn't. Constantinople will fall. The Byzantine Empire will fall. Jerusalem stayed in the hands of Muslim control, and they didn't stop Islam. The Mongols almost stopped Islam, as we talked about, but weird quirker history. Their leader died, so they all packed their jacks and went back for the funeral, which really saved Islam's bacon on that one, to mix a bad metaphor. Please, if you're upset with this and you listen to this on the web, don't write anything negative to Hadabar. It's my fault. The Crusades didn't work. But what the Crusades did was they opened up a lot of stuff. The West suddenly discovered the East again. One of the big deals that happened in this was intellectual openness happened, particularly the works of Aristotle. Aristotle was born in the 320 something BC. He was a student of Plato. Aristotle got the job as the teacher of Alexander the Great. I mean, that's got to be pretty cool if you're Alexander the Great, you know, that you've got Aristotle as your homeschooling guy, right? Aristotle was a brilliant guy. He broke from Plato in his differing views and a different philosophical position. But he was one of the great geniuses to come out of Greek philosophy. Well, he was associated with the school at Athens and whatnot, and that ended up being closed. That started in the 3-something BC and ended up being closed in 529, I think, by Emperor Justinian, because they felt that they needed to get rid of Greek philosophy finally, 529 AD, because it was going to hurt the Christian faith, because it wasn't compatible. So you really had, once the school at Athens was closed, you know, all those guys sort of headed off to the east, and they took Aristotle's writings and teachings with them, and they really weren't known in the West. A little bit was, there was some of Aristotle's stuff stayed, but it was more related to logic and mathematics and those kind of things. It wasn't related to philosophy at all. Well, Muslim scholars copied his work and studied it. And so with the rise of Islam in the East and with the end of the Crusades, this stuff started to come back into the West. And so now in the West, they start to rediscover the works of Aristotle, all the works of Aristotle, those things relating to philosophy as well as those things relating to logic. Well, this was a big deal, okay, because that opened up a whole area of thought that had not been present in the West through the medieval period. The last thing was the way that learning was done changed. We had talked about here that learning had been done, if done at all, really in monasteries early on in the medieval period, and that by now that had changed. As these cities grew, the main church in these cities, the cathedral, became the most important thing. And you know, when you go to Europe, you see the huge cathedrals from this period of time. They're incredible structures, right? Beautiful architecture. And so the cathedrals start to be the place where people go to learn. And they have these cathedral schools. So it shifts. Learning shifts from monasteries over into these cathedral schools. Well, pretty soon, some cities get bigger than other cities, and more people who are important start to go to some cities rather than other cities. The same thing happens today. I mean, there's a difference between, you know, Des Moines, Iowa, and New York City, right? You know, it's just how it is. And, well, same thing happened in the medieval period. Not to demean Des Moines, Iowa. My father-in-law is from there. But the same thing. And so gradually people were attracted to cities that had a great cathedral school. Some more sort of intellectual guys would show up. So now they all start to form these schools in these cities, and they separate out from the cathedral, and they start to form the early version of what we nowadays call universities. Okay, it wasn't quite like, you know, like UCI or Cal State Long Beach or something like that. They didn't have football teams, and they, you know, they didn't have these weird, you know, natural study majors or anything like that. These were more like, they were actually modeled almost like craftsman guilds. The scholars would be there, and you would come as a student to this, and there was a set thing that you did. As a young person, you came, and you had to study for years, 12, 14 years, in your basic studies. And then you got to go and do more advanced studies, more specialized studies, usually in, depending on the city and the school, some were theology, some were logic, you know, depending on what it was, some were mathematics. You could study it, and you would start your study after this long period of time of the general stuff, you would start your study to become a bachelor. Okay, we still have bachelor's degrees today. And that's just, that was basically a depending on how you look at the etymology of that word. Some folks think it came from French, some folks think it came from German, but basically it was the thing that was, when a young man was learning to be a knight or an apprentice to a trade, he was a bachelor. That's what it was called. And so you could get your bachelor. And then after you studied for a number of years, you got better, you were a master at your what you were studying, mathematics or philosophy or theology. And then when you got really good and you could, by the time you were a master, you could tell other people about it. See, as a bachelor, you could ask questions, but you weren't good enough to tell people about. As a master, you could start answering some of those questions and telling people about. Well, the final level was you became a doctor of whatever you were studying. And then you were able to teach others. You didn't just talk about it, you actually could teach others in this, and you could decide things. So these systems developed, this university system. So we have these this change in the economics, these begging monks and whatnot. We have the residual from the Crusades, the teaching of Aristotle and whatnot is now available, and we have these university-type places. Well, all of this created a climate within the Christian church where it wanted to swing away from these sort of mystical ideas that had been prominent in the Middle Ages to more of the goal now became to, through reason, explain the Christian faith. Okay? That happened for a couple of reasons. One, it was a direct reaction against Islam. All of a sudden, Islamic teaching starts to hit Europe. Right, it's already in Spain, it's up in northern Africa, it's bleeding over from the east, over from Constantinople. And the Christian church is going to have to defend itself against Islam, theologically, not just at a sword, but theologically. You have other heresies, we'll talk about that in a minute, and the church has to defend against that. But most of those heresies, you could just say, well, no, we disagree with you, and because we're the church, you can't teach this. But Islam was a different deal. You had to confront a different religion that was coming in on your doorstep claiming something different. Plus, if you think about it, you know, you're out there, you're a farmer or merchant, you're doing this stuff. It's all just stuff that people tell you anyway, right? And so, you know, you've got a religion that believes in a single God that has all these things, and here comes this other guy who says, well, I have a religion that believes in a single God, and he's the same God that you guys are talking about, and so now the church really has to put up some defense, right? The next thing is it's a reaction within society, and this is the beginning. Remember, this is the beginning of the Renaissance here. We're seeing the seeds of the Renaissance. It is a reaction in society against authority. Against religious authority. Christians are saying, well, why do I believe this? I don't need to believe it just because the current pope says or the current church council. I want to know why I believe this. That's not good enough for me anymore. And the third thing is it's a reaction against this sort of weird superstitious stuff that's still going on. Right? We're still in the Middle Ages. People are still having ecstatic visions of things, and they're still being attacked by demons on the road at night, and there's all this superstitious stuff. They wear amulets, and they still have maypoles and these kind of things. And so all of this stuff, now the church is reacting to that in a movement that we now call scholasticism, which was the basis of this was to expound Christian teaching using reason. That's a big jump. Okay, in the Christian church at this point. There were a lot of guys that were scholastics, okay, and this was a movement that lasted for a period of time. The guy that I think was the most important was a guy named Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas was, I think, a brilliant guy. He influenced, to this day, he influences a Catholic theology hugely, okay. Aquinas was an interesting guy. He was brilliant, and he has kind of this fascinating life. Now, you know, whenever you read these stories, especially about guys in the Middle Ages who later on become saints, right? Aquinas became a saint later on. I sometimes suspect that he wouldn't have been comfortable with that, but he was, so he was made a saint later on. They do that after you die, by the way, so you can't refuse it if you're, you know. So. But anyway, Aquinas, so you get some of these stories, but they're kind of fun, and when you hear about these guys' life, and say, you know, some of this you can't verify, there was no newspaper account of it, or you know, I guess you can go on the web to Wikipedia and find this stuff, but whether that's true or not, we have to concern. But Aquinas was born to a fairly important aristocracy sort of level family, right? They got money, they got power, and the story is that when his mom was pregnant, this hermit beggar monk saw her and said, child in your stomach will be a great man, a teacher surpassing all others. And mom thought that was pretty cool, so she said, okay, this is a good deal. When little Tom is born here, we really have to make sure this guy's moved in the right direction. Now, whether this prophecy occurred or not, you would understand that in his family, that was what was expected of the children, right? To be educated, to become part of the aristocracy, to be part of the ecclesiastical superstructure, and be a teacher, and you know, so they really had high hopes for Tom. And after he was born, they did, as any kid in his position would be, when he was five, they put him in the monastery in their area, which was the place where you learned. And so at 5 years of age, he goes in and he starts learning, and his learning at that time would have been a general sort of thing, mathematics, logic, you know. That was the one thing that the school system then taught that we sometimes miss today. Not so much what you know, but how to know what you know. You know, I don't know a lot of schools, their high school kids have to take a logic class, have to take, you know, a grammar and syntax class, you know, to learn how to learn, type of things. But anyway, Thomas had that. So he's in there 5 years, when he's five, and about when he's 18, he's doing really well. Everybody is saying, this kid is a genius. He is something. We need to get him out there. This guy is just outstanding. And his family's very proud of this. Dad had passed away, but Mom was hugely proud of Tom. And so he, though, decides that, you know, religion is hugely important to him. And he wants to be a preacher. He wants to go out and tell people about Christianity and the truth of Christianity, because he's a well-learned child. So when he hits about 18, he joins up with one of these begging monk groups. He joins the order that was founded by Dominic of Osma. He becomes a Dominican. And remember, their job, they preached. That's how they made their living. And so he applies and gets accepted to be a Dominican. Well, this absolutely freaks Mom out. This is not the plan for little Tom. And so she and his brothers actually kidnap him and take him and imprison him in the family castle. They lock the kid up. He's a, you know, 18-year-old guy. And they keep him locked up for about 2 years. And during that 2 years, Mom is all over him. I mean, and you can... We've all had moms, right? My mom is wonderful, by the way, and would never do this to me. But, you know, apparently she was all over him. And, you know, how dare you do this? This is not the career you're supposed to have, blah, 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 blah. Just raking him over the coals for 2 years, keeping him in prison, not letting him out of this little castle, right? His brothers take a different tack to this. They figure, well, wait a minute, Tom's about 18. Ah, they provided, as the stories go, they provided temptations to Tom. One of the stories is that they decided that if they brought a rather attractive young lady to his room, she could persuade him to give up his religious vows. Now, the stories that are against this sort of process will tell you that Tom at one point picked up one of those little fireplace pokers that happened to be in his room and chased this young trollop out of the room and was thankful that he was delivered from this temptation. But however much that is true or not, I don't know. I could imagine his brothers thinking this was a good way to get Tom out of the begging monk thing, you know. But after a couple of years of house imprisonment, they all reached an agreement, and Mom decided, okay, you know, Thomas can go out and do what he wants to do. So they release him. He goes back to the Dominican order, and he goes all the way through, takes his vows, becomes a priest, and now becomes one of these traveling begging monks, this Dominican preacher. And he preaches everywhere, and the guy is a huge hit. They can't believe how great this guy is. And he starts to write. And again, Aquinas is a brilliant guy. Okay, he would be a brilliant guy today. He was hugely brilliant in the late medieval period. And the work that is the most well-known by Aquinas, probably when you talk about Thomas Aquinas, he wrote a lot of stuff, but was a work called the Summa Theologica. And that's, it's just Latin for everything about theology. Okay? It's a bad translation. It's been years since I was in Latin. It's everything about theology. It's basically, he wrote a systematic theology. And the way he wrote this was from the point of reason. Aquinas was a huge fan of Aristotle. Okay, he used Aristotle and Aristotelian methods as he thought, how do we present the Christian faith by reason, not just by feeling? Now, Aristotle was not Christian. Aristotle said a lot of things that Christians would disagree with. You really got to kind of tweak Aristotle to make him Christian. I mean, you really do, okay? But what Aquinas did, he tweaked him a little bit, but he used the method and applied it to Christianity, okay? Now, you got to see the huge shift that occurs here. If you remember several weeks ago, a month ago, we talked about that point where Christianity quit being a Jewish religion and began to be a Greek religion, right? There was a shift where, you know, Christianity started out Jewish, right? That's what the book of Acts teaches us. And then it spread out, went to the Samaritans, and then it went to the Greeks. But it remained within that Jewish context. Well, there became a point where the majority of Christians were now Greek, and they weren't Jewish anymore. And remember, I said that the first work, what we call the early Greek apologists, were the guys who had to make Christianity understandable to a world that was not Jewish. It was to a non-Semitic mind, okay? And they did this with Plato, right? They would explain, well, look at, you know, Plato teaches about this, because remember, Plato was kind of very otherworldly. The earth was, human things, fleshly things were not as important as spiritual things, right? And so to a Greek mind that was understanding Plato, the Greek apologist could say, oh, well, we have a God, you know, the God of the Bible, who is all spirit, right? He's out. And so they could use this stuff as a bridge to explain Christianity to a Greek mind. Right? That makes sense, right? You guys get that. Paul did a similar thing at the Areopagus, right? He didn't stand up and say, listen, all you pagans, you know, listen to me, I'm going to whip the gospel on you. He'll pull out the four spiritual laws or something. Paul was a smart guy. He saw it, Paul understood, and he saw the altar to the unknown God, and he commended them on being very religious, very important people, and he said, you've got this altar up here to the unknown God, and I'm going to explain to you who that guy is, right? And he used that as his intro to evangelize, right? Well, that's what the early Greek apologists were doing. They were using Plato as a way to get folks to understand what was going on in Christianity. It was good and bad. It was good in as much as it got Christianity out there to folks that weren't used to that Semitic, you know, little cradle that Christianity came out of. It was bad in that it started to tweak how Christians thought about God, and to make God more philosophical, and to make God more otherworldly and only spiritual, and it created this separation that is not biblical, but it created this separation that somehow the spirit world is good and the physical world is bad. And that was great, because the Bible talks about how bad the flesh is and sin and everything. So this worked. Well, but it gave way to this whole idea that you know, it was all about the spirit world, not about the real world. And so when Aquinas picks up Aristotle, that changes how Christians view God and view the world. Now Aristotle is saying, no. The world is valid. You know, there's a spirit world, but the world is valid. There's form, there's substance, there's all this stuff. And so Aquinas uses this in a way to now teach Christianity in a way that is non-Platonic, but that is understood within the context of when Aquinas lived, right? In the late Middle Ages. This was a big deal. I know it doesn't seem that way to us, but this was a big deal back then. I wanted to read two things about Aquinas tonight. One, I love this. This is Francis Schaeffer. Schaeffer talked about Aquinas, and I love these quotes about Aquinas. This is out of Schaeffer's... Schaeffer's work, Escape from Reason. Okay? Chapter 1. Nature and Grace. He says, the origin of modern man could be traced back to several periods, but I will begin with the teachings of a man who changed the world in a very real way, Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas opened the way for the discussion of what is usually called nature and grace. So Francis Schaeffer is not a bad guy. You know, most evangelical Christians, even non-evangelical, you know, Catholics, Orthodox, they like Schaeffer. And he's a smart guy, too. So he rightly, I think, points to Aquinas as being really important. He says that prior to Thomas Aquinas, there was an overwhelming emphasis on the heavenly things, very far off, very holy, pictured only as symbols, with little interest in nature itself. With the coming of Aquinas, we had the real birth of the humanistic elements of the Renaissance. Now, that's important, because that's where history is going right now at this period of time. As Christians, a lot of us, we start getting nervous when we hear words like humanistic and Renaissance, because we're taught that that's not good stuff, okay? And when it's interpreted poorly, it's very bad stuff. It's bad theology. But if we can look at what was going to occur in the Renaissance was this reawakening of all those things that are good about mankind. Knowledge and art and a shift in culture from a blind authoritarian, whether it be a king or a religious leader, to more of the idea that more of an more of a Republican kind of spirit, not in the Democrat versus Republican, but as you know, the people are leading themselves kind of idea. All of this is coming up in the Renaissance, and Aquinas is setting the stage for this on the Christian side. Again, Summa Theologica was the work that most people know. There's a lot of stuff that Augustine wrote or Aquinas wrote. I don't know why I keep saying Augustine this evening. Brain synapse that's not firing. But one of the things I wanted to read tonight, just to share a little bit from Aquinas' work, was something that he did on out of the Summa Theologica on whether the existence of God can be proven. Remember, everybody knew God existed as Christians, right? They just knew. They absolutely knew that. They never had to prove it. It was taken by faith, right? Not faith the way we talk about, you know, when you read Ephesians 2:8, we're saved by grace through faith. Biblical faith, what Paul was talking about there is the idea of faith is I am persuaded to the truth of the message of the gospel. Right? That's when we talk about faith in the Bible, that's what we mean. It's a persuasion of the truth that the finished work of Christ on the cross and understanding Christ as Messiah is how we have eternal life. It's what John says at the end of the gospel. So you'd believe that Jesus is Christ, and from that you would have eternal life. And that's faith. In the medieval period, faith was this idea of just simply believing stuff. You know, without real rational proof, and Aquinas is addressing that. So he's talking about this, whether God's existence can be demonstrated. He said, we can therefore demonstrate that God exists from what is not evident to us on the basis of effects, which are evident. In other words, we can prove that God exists other than just saying, well, yeah, I believe he exists. We can actually offer fairly substantial logical proofs about this. This is hugely important. Think about this. This is now, you can prove this to somebody who disagrees with you, who is a different, completely different religion. You can prove this to yourself so that if you worry, well, boy, maybe God doesn't exist, I can prove it to my... There's a logical proof. This is what Aquinas is bringing to the table here. Yeah?
Is that where we get apologetics from?
You know, Aquinas' work, especially in this area, is used hugely by apologetics. Yeah, we see apologetics starting. You can trace apologetics back earlier than this, but a lot of the stuff that comes out of this period is used for Christian apologetics even today. I mentioned last week one of the big things that's used today in the proof of God area is actually an argument drawn from Islamic scholars that we use now. It's a mathematical argument that we use as a proof of God. I had mentioned in J.P. Moreland's book, Scaling the Secular City, he references this, and then, yeah, I still cannot remember this other guy. There's another guy. I'll think about it. But that argument is actually... But yes, apologetics does use this, but it can go back prior to this. So anyway, Aquinas comes up with five proofs for God. The first one is that the first and most obvious proof, and I'm reading from the Summa Theologica, in English, not in Latin, so this may be different if you read this in other translations, other English translations. The first and most obvious proof is the argument from change. We therefore are bound to arrive at the first cause of change, which is not changed by anything, and everyone understands that this is God. In other words, the idea that there's all change, but something had to start all that, the unchanged change, that's God. So that was his first argument. His second one is based on the nature of efficient cause. We are therefore bound to suppose that there is a first efficient cause, and everyone calls this God, right? There has to be a first cause of everything. You know, that's the big question, quite frankly, in all of philosophical and theological discussions, is not was creation 7 days or any of this other stuff. The big question is that you can always ask anyone, and this works especially well with folks who are trying to attack Christianity, is why is there anything and not nothing? That is the ultimate question. Why is there anything and not nothing? What's the reason for that? It's real easy to get to God from that answer than it is from all this other stuff. Because random chance won't answer why there's anything and not nothing. Okay? That's a big one where you should start. And that's basically the second thing that Aquinas you know, it gets in your head, you know, and you just, you know. Okay. Third way is from the nature of possibility and necessity. We're therefore bound to suppose something necessary in itself, which does not owe its necessity to anything else, but which is the cause of the necessity of other things, and everyone calls this God. So in other words, something has to be that isn't. There you go. A fourth way is from the graduation that occurs in things, which is the cause of being of all things that are, as well as the goodness and their very perfection. This we call God. That's his fourth proof. And the fifth proof for the existence of God out of the Summa is there is, based on the governance of things, there is therefore an intelligent being by whom all natural things are directed to their end. This we call God. So you see, Augustine is bringing up things that to this day we're still using, right? Augustine is coming at this from the idea that we can understand a Christianity a theology from a rational, from using human reason. Now, I would differ with Aquinas. I said Augustine again a minute ago. I would differ with Aquinas because Aquinas held that man can come to God purely through reason. Okay? I would disagree with that. But what I agree with Aquinas, and I think is part of his genius, is that he understood that there is faith and there's reason, and that both of these things are together, just like our immaterial self and our material self during this existence, during our life on earth, is absolutely tied together. You can't separate those two things. When you do separate them, that's death. Okay? When we die, our physical, our material self separates from our immaterial self. Okay? We can't separate faith and reason. Reason allows us to understand things and explain it. Faith is that thing that it's the understanding and assurance of the hope of God. Okay, so those two things are tied together. That's where I think Aquinas takes us. Okay, so this opened up a whole new venue, and this was where Christianity started to move. This was a very good thing. It was also a bad thing because it moved Christianity for a period of time away from the Bible and over to pure philosophical and theological reasoning. Okay? Understand that one of the big arguments that we'll find in the Reformation is away from the kind of reasoning that is not biblically based. Okay? One of the arguments of the Reformation. So it's a reaction somewhat to the extremes of what happens when you take Aquinas out. There are a number of things when you read about Aquinas that would tell you that he would be very uncomfortable with what folks did with his teaching. That after he passed on, that people would, in the name of Aquinas, take Christianity a lot of places where he would have been uncomfortable with it going. Aquinas was a deeply religious man, a deeply spiritual man, who was not just a cold intellectual. Although scholasticism puts us over on the intellectual side of that pendulum, Aquinas had, you know, ecstatic, not visions, but sort of, not trances really, just these sort of ecstatic times of spiritual experience that he would have, usually when he was saying Mass and whatnot. He was a deeply prayerful man, so you know, you had a fascinating mix, and I think some of the people that take Aquinas' work even today and separate it from where he was, I think do a disservice to him. And also there's just stuff that he got wrong. I mean, there was stuff Augustine got wrong. You know, there's just stuff that you know, you look at and you open the Bible and you go, these guys just, they missed it. They went wrong from what the Bible says. But a lot of it was good. Now, so all this is happening in Christianity. On the fringes of Christianity, we start to see the seeds of the Reformation. Next week, we're finally going to get to the Reformation. I'd hoped, the way I kind of timed the class was the first half of the class was everything from Acts up to the Reformation, and then the second half of the class is everything from Reformation to the modern day. And I'd sort of hoped that since we went April, May, June, July, that I would do, on June 1, I would be at the Reformation, and I only missed it by a week, so that's pretty good. What was interesting is what started to happen is all over the West, people started disagreeing with what was the mainstream thought of Christianity. Okay, up in the northern part, up in England, you got this guy named John Wycliffe. Now Wycliffe was a brilliant guy, but he really disagreed with the Christian theology that was coming out of Rome and was the dominant theological views in the West. Wycliffe believed that the church was made up of believers, not just folks who happened to have membership within the Christian church, which by this time was called the Catholic Church. He believed that the Bible was important enough that it had to be in the language of everybody. Remember, at this time, the Bible was in Latin. In this time, people didn't, you know, we have Bibles everywhere. I got a Bible out in my car. I got about 20 of them at home, you know. We got Bibles everywhere. My daughter has her Bible on her iPod, you know. She sits in church next to me, and she's got a little iPod out. And she's, you know, reading her Bible on her little iPod. I thought she was talking to somebody or something. And she had her little Bible there, right? So, but that wasn't the case. Back then, the Bible was this big book that if you were literate at all, you didn't have it anyway. It was in the church. It was in the cathedral. And it was. And actually, what was changed wasn't the whole Bible wasn't changed. It was the thing called the lectionary. Now, the lectionary was all the passages from the Bible that were put down to be read in church for each day. And so, you know, if it's Wednesday in ordinary time, like right now, this is in the church calendar, this is the ninth week of ordinary time. Today, Wednesday the 9th. So when you went to church that day, you'd open this big book up, and there would be the passage from the Old Testament and the passage from the New Testament and some prayers and stuff that had to be read on the ninth day of ordinary time, you know, and that was, it wasn't a whole Bible. It was just little passages, right? So people didn't have the Bible, and it was in Latin when they did have it. Wycliffe said, no, everybody needs the Bible, and it needs to be in the language. If you're German, it should be in German. If you're French, it should be in French. In his case, it should be in English. The church radically disagreed with this. And Wycliffe made a translation of the Bible into English, a very good translation. He was persecuted for that. Now, Wycliffe, most people think he had a stroke when he died, but he died before the church could punish him for being a heretic. Okay, and so they dug up his bones, and they tried him, and then they burned him. And then they scattered his ashes out in the river. Remember, I said that the one pope did that to the previous pope. He was so upset that the previous pope died, and so he exhumed him and dressed the skeleton up in the papal outfit and paraded him through the streets, put him on trial. And of course, since corpses don't offer a good defense for themselves, he was found guilty. And so that pope took the previous pope and had him dismembered, the body dismembered, and then threw the pieces out in the river. So it's sort of a tradition within Christianity to do that. And so Wycliffe, they dug him up, they burned him at the stake because they didn't have a chance to kill him, and then they threw the ashes in the river. He had followers, a lot of followers. They were called the Lollards, and this is the name of the particular heresy, the Lollards. That was actually a slang term up in the UK at the time. It's hard to tell, again, the etymology of that. It could mean hypocrites. It could also mean like idiots or like a dullard. You know, like a real foolish, stupid guy. But anyway, it was a negative term. And Wycliffe's followers were called the Lollards. They were the idiots, the hypocrites, right? A lot of folks followed Wycliffe, okay? The Lollards was a movement that was the church tried to stamp out, the formal Christian church. Another group of folks over more to the east, over in around Czechoslovakia, in Prague, that area, followed a guy named John Huss. His followers called the Hussites. He, again, was critical of the formal church. He called for people to have individual access to the Bible. And he condemned, as did Wycliffe, some of the sacraments that the church taught, especially communion. They were very upset with how the church taught about communion, and they were against this idea of transubstantiation, whatnot, which I talked about previously. Again, the Hussites were viewed as radical heretics, and the church tried to stomp them out.
Did he write a Bible?
No, he did not. He did not do a translation. Peter Waldo. Remember our guy we talked about at the beginning of class? Mm-hmm. Wow, that was good, John. You brought the beginning back to the end of class. It's almost like I plan this stuff. Peter Waldo was a guy who was strongly, one of the reasons why they didn't give him his own little religious order, was he was strongly against the formal teaching of the Christian church at the time. He was completely against the teachings on communion. He believed that people should be able to read the Bible in their own language and understand it themselves. He was against the formal sort of structure of the clergy. The people that followed Waldo were called Waldensians, okay? And he was condemned by the Christian church at the time as a heretic. He died of natural causes, and all his followers kind of all went up into the hills. And after the Reformation, they all kind of came out of the hills, and the newly made Protestants agreed, and the Waldensians basically turned into Protestants, and that's kind of how that happened. The Lollards ended up turning into Protestants up in England. The Hussites actually still exist today as Moravian Brethren, I believe is the current denomination that ties directly back to the Hussites over in in around Prague in that area still.
Huguenots? I'm sorry. Were they Bacon?
No, that was not one of these main these were heretical groups that ended up hanging around.
Okay.
The important thing to think about this, though, this is again, part of what we do when we look at history is we have to understand it not just through, you know, we're all Southern California, Hawaii, 21st century folks, right? And we're all Protestants. We're all children of the Reformation, right? And we're all evangelical Protestants. We're not even, you know, like Presbyterians or Episcopals. We're more like Baptists half the time, right? And which
Pentecostal.
Or Pentecostal. There you go. And so we have this view, and we can't look at history as if we're right and every, you know, we've got to understand history. Remember, we're all children in this continuum of the Christian church. The Christian church that started at Acts 2 is still the Christian church that was during this period of time. It's still the Christian church today, and if the Lord continues to not show up, we'll still be the Christian church of the rapture, right? This is all, I've said it before, it's like a family. You got good folks in the family and you got nutty folks in the family, but you're part of that continuum, and we have to understand it in that way. These guys, we look at them and go, wow, what brilliant, great guys. They're planting the seeds of the Reformation. Yay for them. Because we agree with the side of the Reformers. Now, if I was teaching this at a Catholic church, they'd be going, oh, these terrible heretics. You know, it's a good thing they got suppressed, because look what happened. We got that terrible Reformation and all these Protestants. So, you know, even today, you would choose sides on this. But you have to understand contextually, these guys were saying something that was radically different than what was believed at the time. Okay? And so when they were persecuted, that makes sense that the church would do that. Remember, the church, while it was trying to protect its power and its money and all this other stuff, it was legitimately trying to protect what it felt was the truth of Christianity against heresy. They were, you know, these guys were, they weren't all evil guys. They were trying to protect what they felt was true Christianity. You know, if you, at your church, whatever church you attend, you know, you go to your Sunday school class and say, you know, I believe that the pastor of this church is incorrect. I believe that, whatever you disagree with, you know, that we should disband the elder board and get rid of the deacons. And I believe that the pastor of this church shouldn't be paid, and that he should call us and have us tell him what he's going to preach on Sunday. And find out how quickly you're asked to leave that body, right? But then we would understand that, because if somebody came to your Sunday school class that you sit in and started saying stuff like this, you'd go, we need to get them out of here, right? Or if they even came in and differed with you and said, you know, this whole thing, this whole thing about Jesus and the God the Father and the Holy Spirit being equal and everything, you know, that's really not true. You know, Jesus really is only equal to the Father. You know, the Holy Spirit's separate down over here, you see, and you guys just don't understand. And let me show you in the Bible where it says that. You would immediately say, well, this guy's got to go, you know, if we can't bring them to the truth. That's what it was like back in the late medieval period when the Waldensians showed up or the Lollards showed up or the Huss. That's the Christian church was us sitting in our Sunday school class, and these were the guys coming in saying stuff that we're going, whoa, wait a minute, get this guy out of here. I mean, you've got to understand, that's how it was. Now, I wanted to end tonight reading, because I like to read stuff in here from, like I say, from primary sources. This was one of the they condemned John Wycliffe's teachings in London. And they formally condemned his teachings by saying that these are the things he taught, and these are the things we condemn. Well, it's a good way for us to see what he taught and to see what they were disagreeing with. And there's a ton of these in here. I'll pick out some of these. He said that this is what Wycliffe taught, that Christ is not in the sacrament, meaning communion, okay? That Christ is not in the sacrament essentially and really in his own corporeal presence. See, again, the church taught at this time that Jesus was right there in the bread and wine at communion. And Wycliffe said, no, he's not. That's a big deal. And they condemned that. They said, this is what this guy said, we condemn it. He said that... well, they were also throwing in a couple, they did say. They condemned that God ought to obey the devil. Well, Wycliffe never said God has to obey the devil. I think they were making that one up. They condemned that Wycliffe said that it is contrary to Holy Scripture that ecclesiastics of priests, bishops, and everything should have possessions. Wycliffe thought that priests and bishops and everybody shouldn't be really wealthy, and so the church condemned that. This is interesting. They condemned that Wycliffe said that any deacon or priest may preach the word of God apart from the authority of the apostolic see or a Catholic bishop. That was radical. You see, the authority was in the church, and so anything that was taught had to be, you know, by the church. And Wycliffe said, no, that doesn't have to be the case. Well, that was one of the things they condemned. I love this one. This would upset even Protestant churches today, by the way. That tithes are mere alms and that parishioners can withdraw them at their will because of the misdeeds of their curates. So in other words, if you don't like the priest or the pastor, you can take your giving back. My church would be uncomfortable with that one. And I have a very biblical church. I go to a very wonderful church. So I'm thinking that they would be a little worried by that. That he who gives alms to these begging monks, by that fact, are excommunicated. Well, Wycliffe taught that, and they said no. That holy men have sinned in founding private religions. Wycliffe thought that, you know, if we're a group of like-minded people, we can plant our own church. And that was, you couldn't do that. If you had a church or your own group of religious folks, it had to be officially from the church. And this is my favorite, he taught, and they condemned, that if a man be duly penitent, truly sorry, any outward confession is superfluous and useless. In other words, that if we go to God on our own and say, whoa, okay, I've sinned, I'm covered by the blood of Christ, I'm really sorry that we're really sinned, the church taught that you had to do that through the sacramental function within the church, and you had to go confess to a priest. So that's what they were condemning. That's what Wycliffe was teaching. Now, to us, that stuff sounds like, well, that's just good biblical theology. But at the time, that was radical stuff. If you were in charge of the church and you were defending what you thought was Christian orthodoxy, that was radical stuff, okay? Okay, next week we're going to look at, there was a little problem with the papacy for a while. A number of guys all claimed to be pope at the same time, and they just couldn't get along. And then we're gonna look at how the Reformation began. I love the story of the Reformation. It's just this, again, this history is so cool when you kind of see all the warp and woof. And I always love that Protestants love to go to Rome and see the Sistine Chapel and say what a beautiful, incredible thing it is, and they don't realize that that was the reason why the Reformation started. So, you know, that's... I'm kind of bumping history a little bit there, but it's close. So we're going to start looking at the Reformation next week. Okay.
Hey, John, did you get a chance to see...